The sentry walking the foredeck was a small, wiry man in loose, dark pants and shirt. The cloth wound around his head would have been a deep green, had there been any illumination there on the foredeck right by the freighter's blunt prow. The captain and crew kept the Solomon Kane dark. The AKM strapped to the sentry's shoulder was almost as long as he was. He didn't even notice the hollow-tipped 180-grain 45 caliber bullet as it reached his right temple. Men swarmed over the railing to either side of the bow. The intruders wore black uniforms with black boonie hats, black boots, black web gear. Their faces were blackened. Their suppressed submachine guns, HK UMP-45s with suppressors screwed on their barrels, were likewise black. The dark hilt of a short sword jutted over each man's shoulder. Using a variation of the approach that had been used to steal the coffin from them, they had come in motor launches from over the horizon. The Kane was not a particularly prepossessing nor well-maintained vessel. If it even had radar, it probably wasn't functioning reliably. Not that their three small inflatable boats would have been easy to pick up. The freighter's crew seemed a lot more concerned with not being seen than seeing. Given the general blackout, no spotlights swept the water. A fire team of four invaders knelt to cover their comrades with shouldered weapons. Two more quartets ran aft to press themselves against port and starboard ends of the deckhouse. A man walking sentry on the deck before the bridge must have sensed something amiss. He came forward to the rail to peer into the night without attempting to unlimber his own AKM. One of the four men from the first squad swung his UMP in the sentry's direction. The turbaned head jerked before the man toppled over the rail to land hard on the main deck. No bullets came near the raiders, who were still climbing aboard and moving according to a hastily choreographed but well-rehearsed scheme. As two more fire teams came up, one man from each of the first two quartets to the deckhouse twirled a grappling hook briefly from a black-painted fist and tossed it upward over the rail. Captain Torolf Sigurdsson's heart sank in horror with the disappearance of the sentry guarding the deck.
I'm getting too old for this shit.
We use radio telephone!
The captain looked over at the leader of the men his employer had hired to protect their precious cargo. He and his aide wore auto pistols in flapped holsters. The third man, clearly a mere foot soldier, carried a Kalashnikov slung on his back. All three men wore curved, bladed swords thrust through their belts. The archaic weapons seemed as much a badge as the racing green turbans. In his youth, Torolf Sigurdsson had been eager to live up to the tradition of his Viking forebears. But in his declining years, a taste for alcohol and a disdain for the niceties of maritime law had sullied his professional reputation. He had been lucky to find employment with the somewhat shady holding company, nominally headquartered in Monrovia, who owned the Solomon Kane. From scattered hints, he gathered the company in turn was owned by someone in the People's Republic of China. Despite his lapses in judgment, and maybe even morals, he had never stooped to piracy, nor once considered it. And while he had no more patience or reverence for customs and taxes than he ever had, he drew the line at terrorism. Unfortunately, it seemed his employers did not. Cursing the wakefulness that had driven him to this late-night visit to the bridge, Sigurdsson nodded to his own radio man, a diminutive Ghanaian national who insisted on being called Bob. Bob, ebony face sweat-sheened beneath his baseball cap, leapt up from his seat. The leader's lieutenant, still standing, picked up the handset. Suddenly, the bridge filled with garish blue-white light. Another vessel, whose approach his radar man had marked just before all hell broke loose about him, illuminated the Kane with spotlights. His four bridge crew, the radar man, Bob the Ghanaian, the helmsman and the officer of the watch, a Christian Lebanese named Saouf, who was having a hard time concealing his terror, had all thrown themselves flat. The remaining two terrorists, the leader and the guard, crouched behind the captain. The guard straightened briefly, raising his weapon towards the swarm of men moving closer to the bridge. The leader, who identified himself as Commander Guntur, unsnapped the flap of his holster. He duck-walked over to the prone captain, pointed the weapon at his grizzled crew cut.
You think you can betray us? I kill you first! Then...
The captain was confused. It seemed as if a giant wave had washed over him, drawing him away from the chaos all around. He knew he wasn't dead. He had a semblance of functional consciousness, yet his senses seemed as if they had disappeared. Perhaps the fight taking place before Sigurdsson's wide eyes, sporadically seen between big, drifting afterimage patches, really was silent. Suddenly, he realized. Flashbang. He was gratified someone cared enough not to throw in a full-strength anti-personnel grenade. Then he realized the attackers might simply be interested in preserving the instrumentation. As his vision returned, he spotted a big man dressed all in black, his face and hands painted black as well, dueling face-to-face with Commander Guntur. His hair was strangely pale. Guntur thrust at his largish belly with his saber. The man swept the blade aside with what looked almost like a Roman short sword. The captain became aware of the third terrorist, the guard, lying on the deck not 2 meters away, staring at the captain with one eye. The other, along with a big part of his head, had evidently been blown off. Sigurdsson became aware that the right side of his own head, the one pressed to the deck mat, was wet with something warm and sticky. He fought to control the rebellion in his stomach. Commander Guntur reeled back. His eyes stared from a mask of blood, black in the lurid light from the other vessel. His opponent had slashed him clear across the forehead. The terrorist leader flung himself forward, slashing wildly with his sword. The burly man stepped in towards him, blocked the stroke forearm to forearm, and rammed his blade into Guntur at the notch of his sternum, angled upward to cleave the heart. Guntur's eyes bulged. Then he seemed to deflate around the blade. The big man caught him and eased him down onto his back. He put a black boot on the chest of the terrorist's corpse. He wiped his sword carefully on the dead man's shirt. He turned, then looked over and down at Sigurdsson.
Are you all right, Captain?
No, but I don't think I am wounded.
Don't worry, Captain. We mean you no harm. Had we done, you would have died with that sword of the Faith Devil. Trust me on that.
The big man nodded his square head. He reached a big hand down as if to help the captain. The black-painted face split in a big white grin. For a moment, the captain looked into those ice-blue eyes. Then he held out a hand and allowed the other man to help him up. Although he was no small man himself, the other hauled him to his feet as if he were a child. To his surprise, the man was clearly, seen closer up, around the captain's own age. He even showed a bit of a gut, although fat didn't seem to account for a high percentage of his bulk. He would have looked ridiculous had Sigurdsson not just seen him kill a young, fit man in a sword fight. The big man's expression turned thoughtful. The captain realized he was receiving radio reports through the lightweight headset clamped to one side of his head.
The ship is almost secure. It will be done within minutes when we flush the last of the rats from the bilges. We will have to confirm against your crew list, but I believe none of your crew has been harmed.
They're good boys. They're too wise to try to play heroes for the profits of another man.
That is indeed wise. Besides, the heroics are provided free. I don't think this lot would have left witnesses behind once you delivered your cargo, my friend.
This wasn't the first time Sigurdsson had suspected his passengers would shoot them and dump them into the sea when they reached their destination. He doubted that was Mindanao, no matter what the charter read. A second man in black entered the cabin.
Ship secured, Elder Brother.
Thank you, brother. Tell the others well done. They have done the order proud.
I have to know. Is that damn box radioactive?
Oh, only metaphysically, Captain. Only metaphysically.
Anya sat in relative cool beneath the gaudy awning of an outdoor cafe a few blocks from the hotel. The white buds in her ears and a playlist of classical music kept the noise of midtown Panama City at bay. There wasn't much to be done about the exhaust smells, especially thick in the heavy, humid air. The coffee shop served excellent coffee and even better limeade. Anya reckoned she could stay there happily hydrating herself until her bladder gave out. It was all she could do at the moment, anyway. In keeping with Panama City's somewhat self-conscious role as a modern financial center, the cafe offered free wireless access. She was trying to find something online about the bones of a stray, very holy man turning up anywhere in history. Luck had not gone her way so far. On one website, she did turn up a brief, tantalizing allusion to a treasure of more than earthly worth that was supposedly unearthed in Jerusalem by an order of knights under the command of the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick II during the Sixth Crusade in the early 1200s. The website went on for pages about how the Vatican had conspired against the knights, beginning before there actually was a Vatican. But Anya knew Emperor Frederick II was a man against whom the Pope genuinely had conspired. Regretfully, she dismissed the whole thing. Frederick had been something of a rationalist for his day. He had only gone on crusade when the Pope threatened him with excommunication, and one of the reasons the Pope excommunicated him anyway was that, instead of reconquering Jerusalem with the usual exemplary slaughter, he had simply rented it from his friend, the equally humanist Sultan of Egypt. He was hardly the sort to found a religious order, much less to set them to searching for holy relics. Anya didn't even know why she was involved in this mess. She was an archaeologist, bound to try to see artifacts properly conserved. In this case, she wasn't even sure there was a relic in the first place. But telling her about the artifact's existence had clearly cost Cedric Millstone his life. Something had left a trail of dead bodies, including those Garin and Anya had been compelled to kill aboard the Ocean Venture, from the time Anya had come within unwitting proximity of it. Ab initio Luján had seen something, a crate whose dimensions suggested a casket, a box to contain a coffin, brought out of the boathouse turned charnel house in the old harbor district of Casco Viejo. So an artifact existed, and it must be of extraordinary value for people to go to such lengths to possess it. Still, she had to be honest with herself. She was more than just an archaeologist now. Whatever historical mystery was behind it, the proliferation of dead bodies made it her concern. She was becoming a protector, maybe even an avenger, and there was much to avenge. She felt a cold certainty that people would continue to be endangered or even killed until she tracked the mysterious artifact down. For now, she operated on the assumption Millstone had told her the truth, at least as he knew it. Deathbed statements, she knew as a historian, were accorded special weight in the law. While she doubted Cedric Millstone had had specific foreknowledge of his death, he must have known he was squarely in someone's sights. A rival or rivals whose identity she couldn't even guess at.
And if I hadn't been so quick to dismiss the possibility of working with his group, all that knowledge might not have died with him.
I beg your pardon, señorita.
What?
I just wanted to make sure that everything was all right, and that you had everything you need.
Anya looked up at her waiter, her eyes meeting his. He beamed. She realized he was hitting on her.
No. Thank you. I'll let you know.
The disappointment was clear on his face, but he nodded and went about his business. Anya pulled out her cell phone from her laptop carrier case and checked the caller ID. It was Frank, the nerd who'd helped her earlier by tracking the Solomon Kane by satellite.
Hello?
Hi, Anya. Something's come up.
Oh?
Your friend's ship has changed course. It happened early this morning, ship's time. If one of my peeps hadn't lucked onto a shot of it from a French bird pointed in a different direction, we'd have lost it completely.
I'm grateful to your friend for tracking it down.
It did cost some money.
I'm good for it. Don't worry about that.
I know you are, Anya. Just thought I'd...
Hey, Frank. Why are you calling me instead of handling this in email?
Well, something's come up.
What?
Well, like I said, we've been pretty lucky so far, but our luck might be about to run out.
How so?
There's some storm systems forming in that part of the world. If the skies cloud over your friend's ship, we can kiss overhead imaging goodbye.
Ugh, all right. Can you at least give me a destination?
Not with any certainty. They can always change course again. But right now, they're pretty clearly heading for the Marquesas in the South Pacific. As a matter of fact, they're making right for a particular island. One that has a surprisingly large airfield from the overhead shot. Apparently, there's an astronomical research station there. I'm not sure the island even has a name, But I have a latitude and a longitude. I'm emailing it to you right now.
Thanks. We'll settle up later.
Great, Anya. Always fun talking to you.
Anya slid her cell phone back in the carrying case. She needed to get on a travel site to start looking for flights to French Polynesia. This wasn't going to be cheap.